The following teaching is part 5 in a 6-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled, Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 2.
We've been talking about the Divine Comedy, and we looked last week at the Inferno and began a word about the second part of 3, the Paradise, or rather Purgatorio, the whole issue of Purgatory itself. We've seen that this is kind of involving a journey of the soul toward God. And in this journey, which is allegorical, so that you don't want to miss the real meaning by looking only at the story, it's the story really of a soul who is returning to God, whose desire is to be compelled by God's love. And in that very process, he goes through hell and sees in a very, very startling fashion the image of those whose choice have led to the bitter consequence of actually hating the love of God, that burning love of God, His holiness, which for those who do not wish it, they find it to be almost as though it were the fires of hell. In that movement, he is guided by Virgil, the poet, and really you have a sequence of poets. You have the sequence of Homer first, and then you move from centuries from Homer to Virgil. Homer gives us an epic about Troy and about the battle and so forth, the conquest of Troy, actually 10 years, and then he looks into the life of Odysseus, the wayfarer, and in that epic you have a picture of Greece, its whole mindset, the way in which the Greece was perceived and understood in its mythology and in its history. Virgil does this for Rome, and in the Aeneid describes the founding of Rome itself. And so you have these two great epics, and Dante sees himself as being in that sequence where his desire is to create a grand scheme in lyric poetry, a scheme in which he portrays the whole vastness of the Christian canvas and has never really been done before. And then later, Milton would seek to do something similar along somewhat different lines, but you have this movement from Homer to Virgil, to Dante, to Milton, and this great series of achievements that somehow convey in poetic form something that really cannot be captured merely in prose, a picture of a unified worldview and how this worldview is transformed by the Christian vision in Dante and Milton. Though Dante depends on Virgil to be his guide, the highest that rationality, human reason can take him. And so Virgil guides him through the abyss of hell itself, and as they go through hell and come out on the other side in the southern part of the world, they reach Mount Purgatory, there to be joined by Beatrice, the one who inflamed Dante when he was 9 years old, when he first saw Beatrice in Florence at her father's house. And from that moment, he was struck by some kind of ecstasy, an ecstasy that somehow transcends merely puppy love, but actually became for him something of the soul's deepest longing. It was a moment of what Lewis would have called Sehnsucht, desire. A desire that really pointed beyond itself to a deeper and more profound aspiration. A longing which left to itself would be a false Beatrice, but the true Beatrice, the true image, would point beyond itself to the archetype of which it is only an indicator, namely the love of God. And so in that moment then, he captures that. Some years later, at the age of 18, he saw her again, and the various meetings that they had. But these meetings were significant. As I mentioned before, she died very young. She was 24. He mourns her loss, writes the Vita Nuova, the new life, and it creates this sweet style of poetry that tries to capture that. He falls in love with Lady Philosophy and moves through philosophy and the quest for the soul's deepest longing. And it's through Virgil then that he finds that reason that guides him. But then it's through Beatrice and through the Beatrician vision that he is carried further up beyond what human reason can do. And so Beatrice actually becomes Virgil's guide as well as Dante's guide through the 7 tiers of purgatory itself. Actually, altogether, there are 10. Just as there are 10 in Inferno, 10 major areas. So there There are 10 in the purgatory, and so 10 also in the Paradiso. And so in this image then, Beatrice guides them both up, and then suddenly at the end of Purgatorio, Virgil disappears. And it's only Beatrice who can carry him up into Paradiso. The reason for it is human reason can carry you only so far. There's a limit. And then he has to disappear. She guides him up further. And so the journey continues. In this story, then, of the soul's movement toward heaven, you have a kind of cleansing that takes place. Let me just give you a word. I may have quoted this last time, but Dorothy Sayers, in a letter she wrote in 1944 to one of the other members of the Inklings, that group that met on Tuesday mornings at the Eagle and Child and on St. Giles Street in Oxford, and included J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Dorothy Sayers, Owen Barfield, and a few others. This group then met and discussed, and one of those people was Charles Williams, whose untimely death led to each of these members of the Inklings writing a sort of festschrift, a sort of a devotional, not a devotional, but a remembrance of him and his influence. She wrote to him and said, first of all, the thing that really surprises me, speaking about the Inferno, the first time she'd read it, is that Dante could contrive to make the story so exciting. I still don't know how he does it. After all, even without having read it, one knows what it's all about, and you wouldn't think there would be any real suspense about it, except a mild speculation as to whether the next clutch of bad eggs is going to be served up poached, fried, or scrambled. In spite of which, I found myself panting along with my tongue hanging out as though it were a serial thriller, careful not to read the argument of each canto beforehand, lest it should spoil what was coming. There's something about how he can take such a static thing and turn it into something that's alive. And that's a great challenge. And then to make even a greater challenge, to make goodness seem palpable, and for goodness to be convincing. It's very difficult to portray a realistically an attractive good figure. It's easier to portray evil figures, but it's very hard to come up with a convincing good figure. It's a great challenge for Dante, for this great poetic cycle, not to sag in the middle, but somehow it sustains it. And in fact, many people who are very familiar with these resources regard it as the greatest part of the trilogy. They regard it as something that has a craftsmanship that is remarkable. As Sayers says in her commentary for the Purgatorio, for the Inferno may fill one with only an appalled fascination, and the Paradiso may daunt one at first by its intellectual severity, but if one is drawn to the Purgatorio at all, it is by the cords of love, which will not cease drawing till they have drawn the whole poem into the same embrace. There is a wonderful picture here that virtually sings. As we move away from the Inferno, we move into a more positive, more lyric image, in which there seems to be a good deal more joy than grief, far more charity than hatred. And what we see here is, in terms of sheer artistry, this second cantica, by comparison with the first one, actually displays a livelier invention, a greater architectural skill, as well as a greater freedom of handling and of technique. He's more sure now that he's reached this part of the poem than he was. There were some faltering images there, but now he's found his way, and he continues to move through and continues to build this great work up to the crescendo that we find in the higher circles or spheres of paradise itself. And so in this movement that we have here, I just want to point out a few things, that as we see, Beatrice takes on a specific role here. And in this role, what Dante's doing is he's leveraging that image that he had that was so poignant for him in his youth, that marked him in a very serious way. And what he's doing now is he's trying to help us move from that from the type to the archetype. Beatrice puts it this way: I am myself, I am not everything. I am but a type of that which is greater than I. Turn from the type to the archetype. When she's completed her work, she quietly hands him over later to Saint Bernard, herself then returning to her own joy in everlasting contemplation. But the point here is that we have is a movement from the that which is the type to the movement of the archetype. That there's an idealistic love that a person can have, but that this idealism, if it's not related and moves from the type to the archetype, can be fraught with various dangers. And there can be a danger of falling in love with a false image and absolutizing that false image. So that what will happen is the false image would bring you ever inwards into narrowing circles of egotism. But the true image, when connected and understood to be a vehicle, a kind of sacramental vehicle, something that points beyond itself to the greater reality, that true image can move us in ever increasing circles outward toward the reality of God and of Christian community. So it's this vision here, the Beatrician vision, was when Dante beheld her in that way, he beheld the universal hierarchy in what he calls the intellectual light, in that moment of ecstasy. Ecstasis really means to stand outside of oneself. And in that moment, then, one's no longer consumed with oneself, blessed riddance, but rather totally consumed with the other, which is really the image that we have of true love, which points beyond and is no longer concerned with itself and its effects, but on the other. Now, that image here, the beatific vision, in other words, the Beatrician vision, is a moment of ecstasy that points beyond itself. But the ultimate vision, what's called the beatific or blessed vision of God, which is the crescendo that we find in the third book, the Paradise, that vision of God eternalizes that moment of ecstasy and causes us to realize that the things we most loved in this world actually, they were only hints of a greater and deeper love. And when you see that face, you'll realize that's the face you were looking for all your life, though you did not know it. And so this is the image of the soul's journey toward its greatest good. Speaking of good, I'd like to make a comment about this. Just as Tolkien very clearly brought that out in The Lord of the Rings, evil is seen in Christian thought to be a parasite on the good. It is not a thing in itself, but rather it is something that is a parasite. The schoolmen understood this as well, picked it up really from Augustine, that evil is a parasite on the good, not the other way around, that only good can originate anything. Evil can only deform the good that already exists. You must understand this if you want to understand Purgatorio, because you're going to discover that every one of these cornices, every one of these rungs around that mountain relate to distorted goods, distorted loves. And it's important for us to grasp then that the nature of the purgatorio is to say that the permanent orientation of the whole personality is that good which it persistently pursues. Even though it might find false loves, it still is looking for something good beyond that. And the ultimate issue is going to be the freedom of the will to choose that good upon which it will arrive. It'll either move toward God or away from God. We saw before that the purgatorio has to do not with punishment, but with purgation. Not to deal with the culpa of sin, the guilt, which has been dealt with on the cross, but rather what's called the reatus, or the stain of sin. And it has to do with removal of that, the very nature of sin itself, to remove that, to purge that. My own view, as I said before, it has to do with the judgment seat of Christ, how Christ will strip that away, and that reality, the consent to sin, the very consent to that action will be dealt with. And that from that point on, after the judgment seat, we will no longer even be able to think sin. And that too will be a blessed riddance. But until that time, we see that in this arrangement, whether we want to see it from the standpoint of something that takes many years or something that can take place very, very quickly, don't miss the point that this is an image. It is an allegory. So don't take it literally. Understand that it has to do with the purgation of that stain so that a person is prepared for the heavenly vision. That's what you want to, you don't want to get wrapped up in the architecture here so much, in the little details, that you miss the major story, which is allegorical. Now, in this arrangement of purgatory, And again, I wish I had my little charts to give you, but I don't have them, and I don't know what to, there's not much I can do about it. The charts are complex enough that I'm not even sure I can try to reproduce them by hand, so I won't even try. The arrangement we have is that purgatory, then, is a place of systematic discipline. It's not arbitrary, it's not random, and so we would expect it to be more highly and more carefully organized than hell. In hell, we see a lot of chaos. In hell, you see people running off in various directions, fighting with one another, endless movements of winds and chaos and so forth, wrathful in the mud of Styx, the ceaseless to and fro of these people in the abominable sand and vulgar buffoonery and all kinds of things. Activities, it seems, without any rhyme or reason. What you have is a meaningless monotony, or you have a sterile fixity. Well, after all, if you think about it, the soul, if in this case, has nothing to do, and all eternity in which to do it. The idea here is that these are people who have fixed themselves away from that very fount of creativity, of light and life and love, and so they are fixed in that static dimension of the egocentricity and the vile loss of creativity and of good. So what we have here in the purgatory, is a far more precise, more symmetrical arrangement in which the activity of each of these circles has a greater content than we had in hell, greater richness and greater clarity. And so what Dante's challenge was, though, to make purgatory not the reverse of hell. But though both deal with the seven what's called deadly sins, or you might call cardinal sins, purgatory is not hell in reverse. But like nature, what you try to do here is you try to see that there are various comparisons and correspondences and balances, but still you want to have desirable variety and surprise, and so he achieves that. The basic structure of purgatorio, is built on a numerical system of 7 plus 2, which equals 9, and then adding 1 equals 10. So 7 is the sacred number, 9 is the square of 3, which is the number of the Trinity, and the number 10 is the perfect number. And then there are 7 cornices that are dedicated to the purging of these 7 capital sins, and those correspond to 3 plus 1 plus 3, which add up then to that 7. And then these are preceded by 2 anti-purgatory layers on the bottom of the mountain, something that Dante invented. And you have yet another layer on the top to make it 10, which is the earthly paradise. That paradise which was lost as a result of the blast of the fall. This is at the very top of that mountain. Now, anti-purgatory, again, you'll have to use your mind's eye, at the bottom of the mountain, deals with people who repented just at the last moment. And so these are people who repented and who turned their hearts toward God just at the moment of death. You also have other people who have done this who delayed repentance until the moment of death, and they're divided into the indolent and the unshriven and the preoccupied, and so they have a period of detention. They arrive at Peter's gate, and at Peter's gate it deals with the fact that there are 3 steps of penitence: confession, contrition, and satisfaction. Dante receives 7 P's on his forehead, speaking of peccate, the Latin word for sin. And each of these P's will be erased as he moves one rung higher on the ladder. So as he goes one higher, that angel corresponding to that particular level will erase that as he goes through this experience. And we see that purgatory proper, then, these punishments, as I said before, are not penal, but rather purgative, and they have to deal with the stain of sin, which these 7 root sins are dealt with. Not simply the symptomatic sins, one might say, but rather these are the sources of sin itself. If good, then, is that which upon which evil feeds, then we would expect that all the capital sins are shown to derive for love of some kind of good. They all derive from some good, but that's distorted. So that in lower purgatory, we deal with the perversion of love. And so in the first cornice, we deal with pride, which is in the bottom level. And that has to do with the love of self, which has been so perverted that it leads to hatred and contempt for your neighbor because you're so full of pride for yourself that it leads to the distortion of hatred for your neighbor. The next cornice has to do with envy, and that deals with the love of your own good, which is perverted to the wish of depriving others of their good. In other words, it is resentment of another's good fortune or a desire, if you can't have it, they shouldn't either. Another distorted love. A third distorted love is wrath, which is love of justice, but it's perverted into revenge and spite and hate and unforgiveness. So those three loves are loves that have been perverted. As we move higher up, we move toward mid-purgatory, love that's defective, and that's the sin of sloth or acedia, which is a failure to love any good object in its proper measure, not enough desire to love God actually as he really is. The next movement up is the movement toward excessive love. There is the movement of the cornice number 5, which is avarice, which is an excessive love of money or an excessive love of power. Moving up from there, you move to gluttony, which is an excessive love of pleasure, and the highest, which is lust, an excessive love of persons. But notice that the warmer-hearted sins are on the top, and that these cold, egotistical sins are at the bottom because they exclude reciprocity and exchange with others. At least the ones on top have a reciprocity dimension to them. The ones on the bottom focus on the coldness of one's own ego. And again, you'll recall that in hell, that we move from the sins of the flesh into the sins of the spirit, and finally to the worst sins of all, of treachery and of the pride that led to Lucifer's downfall. And so we have that imagery kind of in reverse. Again, use your mind's eye, but each of these, the architecture, I have a little chart that would have shown that, but the penance, that there is actually, with each cornice, there is a corresponding penance, which is appropriate to the sin. It either takes the form of the endurance of the effects of that particular sin, or it happens to do with the practice of the opposite virtue. There's also in each of these cornices a meditation, and this meditation consists of what's called the whip, which is the opposing virtue, which is always taken from the life of Mary and from others, from profane and sacred history. And then there's also called the bridle, which are deterrent examples of the sin itself to show what the consequences of that sin look like. There's also a prayer that goes along with each one of these, as well as a specific benediction taken from the Beatitudes and an angel. So it's a very complex structure that when analyzed, you realize all that's there, though a first reading of the poem, you might not even notice that structure. It's woven in there, but it's subtle. It's not pedantic. It's there, but that architecture only unfolds itself the better you get to know the poetry. And then at the summit of Mount Purgatory is the earthly paradise, the place of innocence, which is now empty because of the fault of giving ear to the serpent. But ultimately, this will be peopled. And we have this idea, though, that even there, that God wastes nothing. And this whole concept of purgatory, even sin, is not wasted. At the very top, there are two rivers that Dante must drink of. First river is called Lethe. And this is, again, all taken from Virgil and from Greek imagery, as well as the Latin and the Greek imagery. Lethe destroys all memory of evil and the sin that goes with it. And then he drinks of a second river, Eunoe, which means a good knowledge. And that has to do with restoring remembrance of the sin, but only as an historical fact, as an occasion of grace and blessedness. And so he is now prepared to move up into the next level, which would be the top of the mountain, as he goes from the top of the mountain where Virgil disappears and Beatrice takes him up to the next level, which is paradise itself. Now, as we move into that, we discover as well that as Dante moves higher and higher, his weight of sin gets lighter and lighter, so it's easier and easier for him to move up. Remember how tall this mountain is. It's about 3,000 miles high. And so it gets easier and easier for him to move up on that mountain, the seven-tiered mountain. As we think about paradise itself, in spite of the fact that Dante has gone through all these experiences of hell, and now this purgation of the seven sins, or cardinal sins, and all that he's experienced, all the people he's dialogued with and talked to, and seen all these images of these meditations, these angels, all these things that have gone before him, he's still not ready for paradise. It has been said that the joys of heaven are an acquired taste. And this image of Paradiso is really a story about how one acquires that taste. And what Dante does so brilliantly is to involve us, because we see we are strangers in paradise. We are strangers there in heaven. And Dante then at least is known to us. So he becomes a type of our own selves as we go through that. And in that very process of wonder and of fear and of amazement, he moves through this process and begins to become more accustomed to the radiant vision. His vision of the love of God continues to grow and become strengthened as his clarity of love and understanding merge together. So it melds mind and heart together in this wonderful vision of what paradise is about. And in this sense, I must tell you that this work displays, I think, an astonishing courage to build through 33 cantos, all that, about 5,000 lines. And for you to pull this off, to make heaven persuasive, is no easy task, I promise you. What it was involved in doing this, and to build it to a climax through this lucidity of line on line, and he piles up dogma upon dogma and sphere upon sphere, getting higher and higher and higher, and actually moving us so that we can almost sense what it is like to have a higher level of joy, of radiance, and of beauty. Indeed, this whole work is rich with images of light, of dance, and of music. And in this picture, you almost see the sacred dance, the cosmic dance itself, all whirling around in concentric spheres, describing the glories of that love which moves the sun and other stars. And so we build this up to an ecstatic climax in this marvelous journey. And we see in the structure here that what his desire is for us to see is that there are several levels. In a letter that he wrote near the later in his life, when he was during that period of time, his 20-year exile from Florence, one of his patrons was the Lord Congrande della Scala. He was vicar general of the city of Verona. And Dante stayed there, and Dante dedicated some of a portion of his Paradiso to him in an epistle that's become well known. And in this epistle, we have the author telling us how to interpret his work. Would that it was always that convenient. And he says in this epistle that it is meet for this exposition to be both literal and allegorical. And so to make this intelligible, it should be known that writings can be understood and ought to be expounded chiefly in four senses. The first is called literal, and that's a sense which doesn't go beyond the strict limits of the letter. The second sense is called allegorical. And this is where we have a truth that's hidden under a beautiful fiction. The third sense is the moral. And that moral sense is what does it teach for our profit? And how should we respond? And the fourth sense is what's called anagogic or anagogical. And that speaks of the spiritual exposition. And so Dante calls his work polysemous, or you might call it a polysemantic. That is to say, it has many levels of meaning. Although we can take those images of the allegorical, of the moral, and the anagogical, and call those all collectively the allegorical meaning. So we have the story, and you have the symbolism or the images in that story. So you have this movement, as we move through this, of two levels that we need to keep in mind and make distinct, because our big mistake will be to take this, as I said earlier, too literally and miss the point of it all. And the point of it all is that this is really the journey of God to God, rather, as the journey into reality. It is the journey away from the appearances and the images into the very source of life and light and love. To know all things in God is to know them as they really are, is the idea. And so he takes the beauty, that eternal beauty that shines through the created beauty, in this case Beatrice and the other images of desire that he had, and using the Ptolemaic structure of the cosmos, in which the earth is in the center and the various spheres move around them, moving us through. And I had a little chart here that comes in the back of the book. And this chart, kind of like a little pop-out here, which you will not be able to see, but you can look at later, moves us from the heaven of the moon to that of Mercury, to Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then from there into the starry heavens, and then into what's called the primum mobile, or the crystalline heaven that moves them all. And above, up and above that, number 10, the Empyrean, the place of God, where time and space are meaningless concepts. And there he sees the vision of time, a river of time, turning into the circle of eternity, which he symbolizes by the mystic rose, and which he sees all things in a kind of present glance. Instead of seeing things as we see now in a sense of sequential movement, he sees things in a synchronous way, all at once. So there's this image of eternal beauty that is being communicated as we move higher and higher. Let me just make a few comments about the organization of paradise then. So the first heaven is the heaven of the moon. And what you have here, again, with each of these 10 heavens, you have various angelic orders that correspond to each of the heavens, various virtues. And so the first of these heavens correspond to the virtues, the four cardinal virtues of fortitude, justice, temperance, and prudence. And then when we move from there, at the end, we move to faith, hope, and charity. And Dante is even given a quiz. He is even tested on these images here through Peter, James, and John, who test him and quiz him and teach him. On each of these levels, there are discourses, philosophical, theological discourses, discourses on human freedom, discourses on the nature of time, the nature of God, and so forth. So it's not merely just describing heaven so much as it is moving us into the world of ideas and precision of thought. In other words, it's the marvelous medieval synthesis. Each of these souls that are encountered represent various levels as well. The first heaven represents those who were inconstant in their vows, but who are now perfected. And each of these levels kind of moves us symbolically through levels of ascent in the active and contemplative lives. But it's important to keep in mind that in Dante, he's actually saying, though, that all of them are one paradise, one heaven. So that while I distinguish these levels, in another way, they're all sharing the same eternal bliss. So he distinguishes them, but makes them the same. The second level, heaven, that of Mercury, corresponds to the ambitious of the active life. And he uses examples like the Emperor Justinian. The third heaven corresponds to Venus, and you can well guess that deals with lovers and those who have loved. The fourth heaven, that of the Sun, is one of illumination, and thus theologians are found in this. By the way, after this, starting with the second heaven and moving all the way up into the ninth, until we hit the tenth, there are no actual images of people. We see them as almost like points of light, but they are not in any way substantial. We see them because of their movements. Together, they may surround them, these points of light, these flames. They may shine in different degrees or different brightness, but that we see no absolutely substantial forms. I'll comment on that in just a minute. The fifth heaven, that of Mars, corresponds to those of warriors and deals with the virtue of fortitude. Charlemagne and William of Orange, others. Sixth heaven, that of Jupiter, corresponds to the just. And divine and human justice is discussed. The next higher level is that of the contemplative. So we move from the active life to the contemplative life. And there you find Benedict and Peter Damian and others. Then he moves and ascends the celestial ladder into the eighth heaven, which is the heaven of the fixed stars, and where the friends of Christ are there, the Virgin Mary, St. Peter, St. James, St. John, and Adam himself. The seventh heaven is that of Saturn. And that deals with the contemplatives. In the eighth heaven, we have then the triumph of Christ itself, the friends of Christ. Above, yet above that, is the ninth heaven, the first a mover, the primum mobile. And there we have Dante's vision of the angelic hierarchies. And there are 9 hierarchies of angels that are described. We move from angels to archangels to principalities to powers to virtues, dominions, to thrones, cherubim, and seraphim. Various people categorize them in different ways, but that's the sequence that Dante uses. But for the 10th level, there is no corresponding angel. There we have what's called the Empyrean. And the Empyrean is the abode of God himself. By this point, Beatrice has disappeared as well, taken her place in the 7th heaven. And Dante is escorted now by Saint Bernard, the Blessed, and he sees there the Blessed in the celestial rose. So she returns to her throne, and the prayer of Saint Bernard is now described in this point. What we have is a portrait then beyond that, as he moves into the Empyrean, of the triunity of God. And in each level, his eyes, his capacity, his understanding continues to increase. I think that that's where C.S. Lewis may have picked up that idea at the end of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. If you recall from reading that, that Reaper Cheap and the others go, as they go further and further toward the sunrise, to the east, the light gets greater and greater, and after a while they begin to drink this water, which is like liquid light, and their eyes become accustomed to the greater and greater light. I think he picked that up from Dante myself. That's just my guess. But the image in which they're becoming accustomed to that greater majesty and that greater presence. What we have here is really visual music, because he moves from God in his triunity, and there's a famous image of 3 distinct spheres that occupy a single multidimensional space. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and yet somehow being differentiated, and yet they're not. They're all one. And then beyond that, he seeks the master image. And in that point of light, that reality of which Beatrice was but the figure, the union of the Creator and the created in the incarnation of Christ is the supreme vision. And he sees it. He cannot understand it. In a flash, it comes to him beyond all understanding and yet known in that supreme moment. High fantasy reaches its limit and then leaves him. In that moment, he feels his whole being reoriented and turning toward God as its true center, as the heavens turn upon their poles. So we have this beautiful picture then of this movement of the soul toward the God for whom it was created. In that image, I would like to point out a word about the concept of man in this. Because the heavenly life is not absorption into, but rather union with God. And so there is always the I-thou relationship, the subject and the object, just as there is the I-thou in the divine Trinity, that you have the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And so in that relational life that we see here is that it's symbolized in Dante's experience, where he had that image of the earthly Beatrice. And then that image was lost and replaced by the heavenly Beatrice in this vision when he sees her in Purgatorio. And then what takes place as he ascends toward contemplation through the various heavens, there's the overwhelming of the images in which we no longer see images at all until they reach the celestial rose, and then the return of the images of these saints as they will be when they are resurrected. And you know what that symbolizes? What it symbolizes in a human life is the birth of the flesh and then the death of the flesh. And then that intermediate state until the resurrection of the flesh. And so you have all of that describing the life's and the soul's true journey. In this concept here, we have a cosmology that's absolutely rich. Although our heaven, our cosmos, is certainly bigger now than it was in Dante's day, when it was supposed that the Milky Way was pretty much, that was the whole thing. And now we realize that the Milky Way is but one of hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. Yes, our cosmos is greater in one way, but it's more sterile in another. It's not peopled. It's vast but empty. Here we have an imagery, and keep in mind a symbolic imagery here, of a ninefold order, rank above rank, of celestial intelligences that are absolute superiors to human life. Each of these intelligences has an inner intuition of the mind and the nature of God. And as a result, there is an ordering in perpetual motion of each of these spheres, and that each order is attracted to the orders above it and guides and animates the orders below it. And so each sphere within the sphere within a sphere is moved by that primal love of God, which moves the sun and other stars. And as we see this then, all finding its climax in God, we see man at the midpoint in this ladder of creation. And at this midpoint, we see if we look downward toward the earth, medieval man was aware of a hierarchy there. That man and that midpoint had a rational soul. But what was below him were the beasts, the animals, and these animals had an animal soul, a sensitive soul, in which they had a soul, but not rational, in addition to life and form and matter. Moving below the animal level would be the vegetative level. And there they had no longer a soul, but life and matter and form. Below them was the life of inorganic matter, and they had no life, actually, but rather form. And finally, there's prime matter itself that has no form, but undifferentiated being. Below that would be the negative existence of hell itself. And so we have man in this midway point, the broken rung in the ladder of created being, the only one that rebels against God's purpose. And that broken rung has to be redeemed by the work of the living Christ, by being incorporated into the humanity of the incarnate Godhead. And so we are brought up. God lifts man up into himself, and thus provides the way in which we too will be brought into the you and me and I and you relationship, that co-inherence that Charles Williams talks about. And so we're drawn up by love into all the grades of the hierarchy below us, and that was our call, was to bring those up and to order them, and to be also really aware of the hierarchical nature of reality. Only in the Christian vision of the divine Trinity do you have a basis for grasping how you can have equality and at the same time authority. Typically what we do is we go to one extreme and it's all authority without equality, which is totalitarianism, or the opposite extreme of all equality without authority, which is egalitarianism. And the idea in the scriptures is that there is a hierarchy without inferiority. And that's found in the perfect life of the co-inherence of the three members of that communion of being that we call God. In this movement then, in this structure of moving into through created being, there are some questions that surface. And one of those questions that surface is the question of timelessness. We don't have any experience of that. And the question of the relative joy of the saints. Because it would appear that the knowledge that other souls exceed some souls in beatitude, somehow, though, he stresses that that in no way diminishes their own joy. But actually the very blemishes or imperfections of character which led them in their earthly life to merit lower celestial grace than others become now a matter for rejoicing, and keeping in mind that all the saints enjoy the pleasures that one another experience, so that there is the communion of saints, so that it is no longer yours versus mine, but it becomes ours. And that is the life then that takes pleasure in those who receive and takes joy in what they have received, because it is theirs, therefore it is ours, because it is all his. And so in this understanding, he stresses this. But it's not a static, although you've moved really in Dante from a philosophy of being to our present time, which is more of a philosophy of becoming. Still, I want to stress that this doesn't mean that there is a static life, but there is still a kind of progress, but a movement toward and growth toward the vision of God himself. That never stops. Dante cannot see things in their essence, as the blessed do, but only in their sequence. But there is this idea that I want to stress that moves and animates this work, all three, that the idea of the blessed gift of freedom of choice to respond and to reciprocate God's loving initiatives, that blessed gift is something that gives us the true dignity of who we are called to be. And we have this choice. We can love these goods in themselves for the sake of the self, but what will happen then is they'll become impediments to the soul's joy. Or we can learn the secret of loving God's goods for God's sake. And then they become vehicles on which we can come to know him. And so that becomes the real chief joy of man. Let me just make a few quotes, and there are so many, but just a few. to describe this concern about the doubt that Dante has about the joys of heaven in the fourth canto of Paradiso. He says, each in the first circle glittereth, and all share one sweet life, diversified. Very important point there, that it appears from this vision that they are differentiated, but really all share this one undifferentiated life, but still diversified, as each feels more or less the eternal breath. They're shown the here, not that they here reside, allotted to this sphere, their heavenly mansion being least exalted is thus signified. This way of speech best suits your apprehension, which knows but to receive reports from sense and fit them for the intellect's attention. So scripture stoops to your intelligence. That is the image there that's given in Dorothy Sayers' translation. I'll be using for the rest of these quotes the Alan Mendelbaum translation, which I found to be very helpful, and just making a few quotes, limiting myself here, from various parts. I'll make these all from Paradiso. The glory of the One, this is the beginning of the first canto. The glory of the One who moves all things, permeates the universe, and glows in one part more and another less. I was within the heaven that receives more of his light. That's the Empyrean. And I saw things that he who from that height descends forgets or cannot speak. For nearing its desired end, our intellect sinks into an abyss so deep that memory fails to follow it. So his point is, I do not have the skill to capture the beauty, the memory, the vision. Have you ever experienced that when you had a dream? That you discerned may have been profound, and as you're pulling out of the dream, the symbolism begins to elude you, and you find you're too stupid to understand the images that were involved. That's kind of an image of this. I believe our subconscious is a good deal smarter. In fact, I think it's an image of what may have been lost at the fall by God's grace, who actually diminished our capacity intellectually, and by God's grace also diminished our longevity. Because imagine if a person were capable, as we are already capable of doing all sorts of awful things. Suppose a person had a five times greater intellect and five times greater longevity, what their capacity for evil would be. It's kind of a frightening thing to speculate. In any case, our capacity is bound now, but the image is that in that day you will ask me no question, you will know as you are known. We see through a glass darkly, then face to face, and then there will be a growing apprehension as we continue in that journey upwards and higher. All things among themselves possess an order, and this order is the form that makes the universe like God. Here do the higher beings see the imprint of the eternal worth, which is the end to which the pattern I have mentioned tends. In the second canto, if I was a body and on earth we cannot see how things material can share one space, the case when body enters body, then should our longing be still more inflamed to see that essence in which we discern how God and human nature were made one. What we hold here by faith shall there be seen, not demonstrated, but directly known. Then we will know intuitively, and we will grasp, and we will know these things in a very, very direct and profound way. A way in which we really don't have any categories of understanding. Brother, the power of love appeases our will so. We only long for what we have, referring to the blessedness of the saints in heaven. Wasn't that a great image? We only long for what we have. It's been well said that if you're not content with what you have, you will not be content with what you want. So I will let you reflect on that, but there is a truth. Here, they are content with what they have. We do not thirst for greater blessedness. Should we desire a higher sphere than ours, then our desires would be discordant with the will of him who has assigned us here. But you'll see no such discord in these spheres. To live in love is here necessity, if you think on love's nature carefully. The essence of this blessed life consists in keeping to the boundaries of God's will, through which our wills become one single will, so that we are ranged from step to step throughout this kingdom. All this kingdom wills that which will please the king whose will is to rule. And in his will, there is our peace. That's probably one of the better known lines. In his will is perfect peace. Every place in heaven is paradise. Just one or two other thoughts. Only man's sin annuls man's liberty, makes him unlike the highest good so that in him the brightness of its light is dimmed and man cannot regain his dignity unless where sin left emptiness, man fills that void with just amends for evil pleasure. And that's why it's saying that God had to pardon man or of himself man had to proffer payment for his folly. Man in his limits could not recompense, for no obedience, no humility he offered later could have been so deep that it could match the heights he meant to reach through disobedience. Man lacked the power to offer satisfaction by himself. That's why he says the godly goodness that imprints the world was happy to proceed through both its ways to raise you up again. For God showed greater generosity in giving his own self that man might be able to rise than if he simply pardoned. For every other means fell short of justice except the way whereby the Son of God humbled himself when he became incarnate. That's good theology, if you just put that together. In fact, the work as he moves from heaven to hell, hell to heaven, becomes more enlightened theologically, and the discourse becomes more elaborate and far, far more ingenious and more precise and more lucid as he moves. Then, like a clock that calls us at the hour, this is the image, this is the sphere of the sun, in which the bride of God on waking sings matins to her bridegroom, encouraging his love, when each clock part both drives and draws, chiming the sounds with notes so sweet that those with spirit well disposed feel their love grow. So did I see the wheel that moved in glory go round and render voice to voice with such sweetness and such accord that they cannot be known except where joy is everlasting. It's a beautiful metaphor that he crafts moving toward the end of the work. And so did the three, form, matter, and their union, flash into being from the Lord with no distinction in beginning, all at once, created with the substances were order and pattern. At the summit of the world were those in whom pure act had been produced, and pure potentiality possessed the lowest part. And in the middle, act so joined potentiality that they never disjoined. So he's talking about that middle point where we have act and potentiality, that middle place in the medieval synthesis. Then sooner than it takes to count to 20, a portion of the angels violently disturbed the lowest of your elements. The rest remained, and they, with such rejoicing, began the office. You can see that they never desert their encircling contemplation. And so he discusses the that process of in heaven. And finally, I'll just conclude with this, speaking of the grace of God. Oh, grace abounding, through which I presumed to set my eyes on the eternal light, so long that I spent all my sight on it. In its profundity I saw, ingathered and bound by love into one single volume, what in the universe seemed separate, scattered substances, accidents, and dispositions, as if conjoined in such a way that what I tell is only rudimentary. I think I saw the universal shape which that knot takes. And then he goes on to end the work, which describes these circles, this that I mentioned earlier. In the deep and bright essence of that exalted light, three circles appeared to me. They had three different colors, but all of them were of the same dimension. One circle seemed reflected by the second, as rainbow is by rainbow, and the third seemed fire-breathed equally by those two circles. How incomplete is speech, how weak when set against my thought, and this to what I saw is such. To call it little is too much. Eternal light, you only dwell within yourself, and only you know you, self-knowing, self-known, you love and smile upon yourself. At the end, he says, here force failed my high fantasy, but my desire and will were moved already, like a wheel revolving uniformly by the love that moves the sun and other stars, is the way he ends the poem.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.